When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right, hello and welcome to His Darker Materials. I'm Dave Corkery and I'm here with my co-host Helen O'Hara. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
And this is, of course, the show where we recap the HBO BBC series His Dark Materials, the adaptation of Philip Pullman's awesome fantasy trilogy. And as always, we are going to spoil everything up to season 3, episode 5 of His Dark Materials. And you're not just going to be hearing from us. We've got interviews with the cast and the crew, which we are plugging into our whole season. So listen out for some of that later on. So Helen, episode 5, what do you reckon on this one?
This was some pretty exciting stuff here. Like, some shit went down, quite frankly.
Yeah.
There were some major movements forward. Yeah, you know, you've got Mary meeting the Malefa and sort of settling in, beginning to learn their language, beginning to learn about this sort of alien culture. Are they aliens if they're on a parallel world, I guess?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I always kind of imagine them as kind of like, what if elephants evolved differently?
Yeah. You also have a huge amount of movement in the Land of the Dead. And you have very exciting stuff for Mrs. Coulter with the Magisterium. So, yeah, I thought this was pretty phenomenal stuff.
Action packed.
Seriously, yeah.
And well, let's start with Mary Malone, because she gets some action in this episode. Because we've been saying, you know, it was all very leisurely with Mary up till this point, and like now, you know, things are starting to get a bit more interesting and meaty. So Mary is learning about the Malefa and their culture, and most importantly, their language. I really liked how they expressed the passage of time here, and the way that Mary is learning this language. And I really liked the use of subtitles in particular here as well.
Yeah, it's really clever. So you see, you know, the Malefa like deliver a huge sentence, and then the subtitles essentially go, "Yes," you know.
Yeah.
It's that thing you say. I think Lost in Translation did a really good job of it, where the, you know, a director speaks for a vast amount of time in Japanese and the translator just gives you three words, you know.
It
felt a little bit like that, but obviously it's not that. It's actually someone just trying to figure out the language one word at a time and spotting a word here and there and being like, oh, I know that one. Yes,
yeah.
I've got that. Thervetha, I know that means beer. But the rest of what you just said, no idea. None whatsoever.
And that is how she's learning this language, is like, yeah, just literally one word at a time and then putting it down in a book. And I think it tells us, you know, Mary is still a scientist and she's methodical and she's treating this language a bit like that. You know, it's kind of just like figuring it out. It's a puzzle, another puzzle for her to figure out.
It is. I loved her book because it felt like a scientist's notebook, you know, but someone with an interest in basically everything, somebody who wants to understand everything. I love as well that they... And this is something that one of our interviewees has talked about, but I love that they added in the gestures of the Malefa's trunk play a role in their language. So she sort of sometimes will flick her hand as she's speaking to them in an attempt to sort of echo that trunk gesture and sort of, you know, presumably add emphasis or add nuance to a word. I love that we see Malefa wheels. So this, for people who haven't read the books, this is something that we've occasionally alluded to and talked about with some of our interviewees in the past, but this is a big deal. So the idea is that these creatures use seed pods from those giant trees that they live among as wheels, and they grab them in their feet and they roll along the roads on wheels. And this is not the kind of mechanic that is described in the book exactly.
Not exactly.
But the idea...
I think fair play to them. They found a way to get it in there without it looking stupid. And ultimately, that's the main objective, right? So
that Exactly. And look, I'm super happy with how they look because I think they're really cute without being Disney, as I said last time. But I think what is great about this mechanism that they come up with is I cannot conceive, and I'm not an artist, but I still cannot conceive of how you make the book Mulephas look anywhere close to this cool. And I feel like this is a really good response. So for those who haven't read the books, the book Mulepha have an almost like diamond-shaped backbone, right? So it's like sort of got four corners, their backbone. And the two middle corners are the legs which hold the seed pod in kind of long claws for that purpose that go through the middle of the seed pod. And then their front and back leg hold the seed pod. And then their side legs just kind of push themselves along like they're sitting on a skateboard. That's the idea. And that's kind of weirder looking, I think, than what they've come up with here, which is it has a sort of skateboardery movement because they're kind of going side to side as they go down the hill, as they push themselves along with their other feet.
It's more roller skates than skateboard, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. And this means that they can have big, flat, cute, likable, herbivore feet and not have long claws coming out in a way that might make you worried that they were going to claw you, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I thought that worked really well.
I think so too. And look, ultimately, I mean, like, people are probably going to complain. Someone's going to complain somewhere on the internet.
Somewhere.
But like, I mean, like, what do people want? Like, I mean, you've got to bring these ideas and this story to life in a way that's not distracting. I think that just would have been too distracting and wouldn't have added anything except to be a pure expression of what was written down the page, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is such a good design. I'm just loving it. I also just love that, you know, we see a bit of Mulepha life. We see the kids playing with seed pods like a ball, like a football. And you get to see them talking to each other, and you get to see, you know, them helping teach Mary the language, actually, not just, it's not like she's there and they're kind of ignoring her. Like Atal, her friend, is clearly going kind of step by step when she, and answering questions when she can and things like that.
I really love the voice that they've produced. You know, it's very with the voice acting and whatever little effect they've done in it, it's very sort of soft and kind of welcoming, and the language itself is quite, you know, it's quite beautiful and like nice and sort of almost mystical, and this whole thing just feels like a nice warm hug, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And it's meant to, I think. They're meant to be this kind of Edenic society, I think. I suspect there's a little bit of a nod, and there's a little bit of a deliberate tribute, and probably people have argued about this for years or talked to Philip Pullman about this already, and I just haven't read the scholarship. But I think there's probably a nod to Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels and the Wynnums.
Gulliver's
Travels, who were the sort of the horsey people who also lived in the sort of perfect society, you know, in that. So there might be an element of deliberate kind of, you know, reference to fantasy gone by, but it's definitely the most benign place in this multiverse.
That we've seen, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And a particular contrast to the other plot here in The Land of the Dead. But I guess before we move on, we should also say, I guess, a couple of other things that happen. Mary's very interested in this word Sraf and figures out through the Amber Spyglass. Very important. That's the title of the book. That I'm just doing the Leonardo DiCaprio pointing meme now for Helen. she figures out that it's dust by viewing it through this lens. You know, she sort of, again, scientifically figures out that the amber is able to show the dust and that's the Sraf. So it's all coming together.
It is. There's a lot of research scientists in this story, aren't they? Between Mary, Mrs. Coulter, Lord Asriel, Dr. Cooper, you know, there's a lot of it going on.
And Asriel has a similar sort of thing, doesn't he, that he uses on the angels to see the dust, you know, that little lens. He's got a sort of a more scientific-y looking thing. Whereas Mary just finds it in the river.
Yeah, finds like, yeah, this sort of, and it's only when some oil from the seed pods gets on it that it really kind of activates and starts working as well, which is interesting.
So let's chat about the Land of the Dead. So this place is a real downer, isn't it?
You know what? I think that's fair. I don't think you're going too far there. I mean, it's just dark, it's foggy. You know, when they go, they step off the boat and the boat almost instantly disappears. God bless him, he does give them a light before he leaves. So fair play to the boatman. But they sort of walk off into what looks like this canyon, you know, that really striking shot of them just walking through these towering cliffs on either side. And then as they go deeper and it becomes more and more oppressive and sort of, you know, there's a roof overhead as well, clearly. This idea, it's not rock, it's people's things.
Yeah.
Which is somehow very, very sinister.
Yeah.
It's really creepy. And I think, I wonder as well if it goes back. You remember in the very first book, there was a lot of talk about how things that conscious people had interacted with have more dust on them than other things. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
So like tools that were made by Stone Age people when they were sort of beginning to become self-aware have dust on them. And I wonder if there's meant to be a thing between that and them making up the walls of this world. I don't know. Anyway, that's pure speculation.
That's nice. I hadn't thought of that. This plot thread is about remembering and memories and storytelling and places. But I think that also relates to things. You know, people get attached to things and objects, and those are linked to our memories. So there is, I guess, a part of ourselves, if you represent that as dust, would, I guess, leave an imprint on a thing. And then there's a shadow of that in the Land of the Dead. So yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a nice idea. Yeah.
And because everyone there is losing their memory. Everyone there is just gradually fading and fading and fading into darkness. And I thought it was beautifully done when Lyris finds Roger, first of all, and starts talking to him and starts reminding him of their life. And basically literally a light goes on nearby, but also like color starts to return to his face and he starts looking a little bit more lively, little bit less corpsey. And then other people start to come around and listen and the light almost starts to spread. And there's that great moment where you can see the dead walking in a direction and you can just hear Lyra's voice. You can't see her at that point, but you can just hear her telling stories. And it's the one noise in this whole empty land and everyone's attracted to it and everyone wants to be close to this. I thought it was such a great adaptation of the book, first of all, but also this idea of this girl can move mountains. She can move worlds just with the power of her, you know, ideals.
Her silver tongue.
Yeah.
No, you're right. And I love the idea that this is getting across, that storytelling has power and it can create, you know, bring communities together, brings people together, it creates movement and can topple the biggest institutions and ideas. Because it's also the power that the magisterium and the authority are using. They're telling their own stories, but they're using stories to define reality and to subjugate everybody. And Lyra is using the same tools to break free of that. And I think it's just awesome, because that's all life is. It's what we are doing right now, is talking about a story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. And you get that so much in this episode, and it's so elegantly done, because also it works the other way. You also have the harpies as well, when they try to almost hypnotize Will and Lyra, and you can see them beginning to almost sink into this trance. And I think what was fascinating, that scene was brilliant, because when the harpy mentions Will to Lyra as part of this kind of massive guilt trip that she's trying to lay on her, if only Will had never met you, that's the bit that snaps her out of it a little bit. That's the bit that kind of enables her to fight back. So again, it's their bond that enables her to scream defiance and then shake Will out of it and then basically, you know, get them back on track.
I like that.
Yeah, that was really great.
It's like what happened when Will was forging the knife and reforging it, and she was the one that kind of kept his focus. Right? They're kind of united and better together.
Exactly, yeah. And so you get her giving a sort of big stirring speech about, you know, in here it's just the thoughts, out there things matter. You've got that old lady who stands up and essentially denounces all religion. So, you know, that could be
yeah, I mean, controversial. There's a lot of religious subtext here, but then there's just text.
That's just full-on text.
She's just like, yeah. they used to tell us that there was a heaven. Yeah. This whole idea is so awful and disconcerting that at the end of, you know, you're made a promise and then turns out there is an afterlife, but it's like, it's this. And somebody says it's not, you know, this isn't life after death, it's a prison camp. To discover that that is the end of the road, this eternal prison camp, is so demoralizing and such a terrifying idea.
Yeah, it's a really nasty, nasty story turn. We do, however, have one of the most emotional beats of the series so far, though, this season. Because, you know, there's this girl who's causing a stir through the land of the dead, and somebody who seems to have kept a little bit of himself to himself is Lee Scoresby, and he comes back to see what's up. And I thought their reunion was absolutely lovely, because she's just gotten through talking about how he is the first grown up she ever trusted. Which I think is unfair to the Master of Jordan College, but fine.
The wonderful Clark Peters. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But for him to sort of just find her, for him to still have a sense of himself, even in this awful place, and for them to get that reunion, I thought was just heartbreaking. And then he just immediately is like, okay, she'll have a plan. Follow her, follow the kid with the knife. I'll go back and round up the stragglers so everybody gets out. I mean, perfect. I'm super into it.
I love that it's the people like him and Yorick who kind of figured out quite early on that there's something about Lyra and that they will just let her do her thing and follow her. And it's people like Asriel who completely disregarded her and has been doing in this season as well, like, forget her, right? And then Coulter, who's just trying to control her or protect her. It's you know, it's friendship and the people that's and loyalty, right?
I mean, I you know, they're men of action, but they're not unthinking men of action. You know, both Yorick and he's not a man of action and a bear of action. But you know, they do sense something in Lyra, as did, you know, John Farr, the king of the Egyptians.
Oh yeah. Oh my God, that feels like so long ago.
So many years ago. But I think, you know, there's always been a sort of game recognizes game element to it.
Yes.
I feel like, and apparently not every player has that when you get to Asriel in particular. But yeah, I just love their reunion. It really made me tear up a little bit, and I thought that was lovely, beautifully played. Right, today's guest is producer Stephen Harron, who started out as an editor on the show and has worked his way up to producing and been really, really key in getting everything onto screen in one piece. As ever with our interviews, there may be some spoilers for the rest of the season, so do please tread carefully if you haven't yet seen up to episode 8. I'd also like to apologise personally, because Stephen is also Irish, and myself and Dave's accents may also get stronger as we all talk together. So if you can't understand anything, I'm sorry. I'll try and provide a translation if you come and chat to me on Twitter. Otherwise, please enjoy Stephen Harron. So we are delighted to be joined by Stephen Harron, who is one of the producers of His Dark Materials. Stephen, how are you doing?
Very well. Thank you for having me in this little Irish triumvirate.
It is a bit
yeah, it's like a reunion. Yeah. I didn't see you guys at the last Irish people reunion.
I was there alone. I thought I was there alone, yeah.
You've been on this show, I think, since the first season. So how does it feel to have it all out the door?
It feels slightly anticlimactic, but it's, you know, very satisfying to see it come together at the end. And I think I feel the third season is the best one. I think it rivals the first. But I think in terms of it's been a very difficult thing to adapt and a very difficult thing to visualize and a very difficult thing to compress and all the difficult things. But I think, you know, on the whole, it's pretty successful, I hope.
Can I ask then, Stephen, on that subject, the challenges of adapting it? You know, Helen and I have spoken about the third book in particular having some really like meaty ideas and visuals. Like, it seems like that must be an absolute nightmare to get to the screen. What were the biggest challenges when you guys were looking at it?
Well, obviously the writers, we had three writers this season, were, you know, at the forefront of dealing with that. But from my point of view, one of the biggest problems was just budget, because you can never do all of the things all of the time. So I think if you were really, really going for it as much as you possibly could, and money was no object, you know, you'd be doing these things wall to wall. But actually, we had to be as ever since the beginning, had to be slightly more choice in what we did. I think that, you know, the Malefo was always going to be a major challenge, but, you know, Russell, visual effects supervisor, and his team rose to the challenge very quickly. That was a kind of a long one in gestation. I think the design had settled reasonably early, and then it became more of a question of how you translate that on screen and dramatically. So that was absolutely, I think from my point of view, that was probably the thing I was worried about the most, which probably through worrying about it, it therefore kind of worked itself through, if you know what I mean, because I worried about it for so long and so often that you kind of go incrementally through that process, even if it's just in my own head, and kind of reached a place with it that felt quite happy, actually. You know, Metatron and the Authority, you know, certainly tricky, and we've gone about it a particular way. That's been quite a difficult one. The rest of it, I think, unless I'm forgetting something, the harpies kind of seem to happen quite naturally. I think, you know, I'd love to have had more harpies, but then, you know, you need more screen time, and you need more money. So, you know, limited by all these things. But I think on the whole, you know, it feels like pretty richly varied palette of things, and I think hopefully we've done justice to all of those different components.
That's awesome. And tell me as well about, you know, your background is as an editor, so you're coming at this from a sort of, okay, it's all very well shooting this, but we also have to put it together at the end and it has to make sense and we have to have all the pieces we need. So, you know, how does that help, I guess, when you go on set as a producer? I mean, it feels like it should
help. I think it does help, because, you know, I had a strong sense. So season one, actually, I wasn't there from the absolute beginning. So I was there from post-production, basically, after the shoot was over. So it just happened that that's when I joined. So that was my initial experience of making the show, was very much, how on earth are we going to make this work? And I've had no say-so whatsoever in what we've shot and how we've shot it. So it was a very kind of reactive, somewhat, I would say, audience, almost like an audience experience of trying to make it work. And they'd actually done a fair amount of editing already, so, you know, they'd explore different avenues, and then I was like reasonably fresh when I turned up. I think that by the time you get to season three, I believe I had a reasonably strong sense of what tended to work for us on screen and certain things to avoid and certain things to pursue. I did want to personally, I'm sure, you know, everyone else had their own versions of this, I personally wanted to try as much as possible to go for a slightly bolder storytelling style, you know, within the limits of what the show is and within the limits of, you know, episodic TV and, you know, 60-minute episodes. So, you know, with actually the Mary storyline is an example of that, where I felt that there was a slightly more cinematic way to go about it. And I was also trying to bring as much scale as possible, if and when I could influence that throughout. So trying to go for, you know, moments, even at script stage, which felt to me slightly more filmic and less dialogue-led sometimes, or ways of staging things that I thought would be interesting. We kind of, you know, worked on that in conjunction with everyone else on the team. But that's, I really felt a need or desire to kind of, you know, really one up what we had done before and just try and improve where I felt that maybe we'd slightly fallen short, just from in my point of view.
Can I ask you a sort of a slightly almost job interviewee kind of question?
Yeah, please. I'm interviewing at the moment, so anything.
Well, I don't have a job for you, Stephen, at the end of this, I'm afraid.
why am I doing this?
Yeah, you've come to the wrong interview. But I'm kind of curious, like, you're in a position where you're at the center of a lot of different sort of creative output. So you're dealing with the directors and the, you know, the cast, heads of department, VFX, right? And you're sort of, as a producer, having to manage all these people. Can you give me an example of a time where you guys were faced with an unexpected or even an expected challenge? And then how did you guys resolve that? I'm always kind of interested in that process.
That's such a job interview question.
Oh, yeah.
I know, yeah.
I probably should be prepared for that. I would probably return to Malefa, although it's not the center. Okay, arguably it is slightly somewhat of the center of the story, depends how or what direction you're coming at it from, but it's a kind of main through line through the story that resolves in quite a clear way at the end, but it's not always at the forefront of the narrative. I guess because it was just a series of challenges and questions, and it just wasn't completely obvious how one approached it. So I guess that's one where we kind of went through it iteration by iteration. I mean, initially, my memory is that at script stage, you know, it was a series of traditional scenes spread across the episodes. So, you know, Mary meets Atal, Atal and Mary have a conversation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I felt quite strongly that the nature of that story, I might be slightly hard pushed to explain why, but I felt kind of instinctively felt that the nature of it meant that it would do better played out in a slightly different style. So rather than cut to Mary and Atal having chat, I felt it was partly because it's about discovery, and to represent Mary's journey of discovery in that world, let's say, you actually need to spend an enormous amount of time in it and kind of live with it. So if you were to, you know, any kind of new world narrative that you can think of from a film is kind of a bit close to that type of idea. But to do that, you really need to hang out. And the thing was that when you spread those types of hanging out scenes across a pretty dynamic multi-narrative, if I'm honest, it sometimes felt that it sank a bit when you then went to that type of scene, because ultimately it's about the feeling of it. So while we were scripting, but very close to starting to shoot that section, I think it was me who said, I think we should, you know, shoot what we shoot and write what we write. But actually, I have a feeling that one way to handle this is going to be to compress it. And I don't mean to compress. Compress can sound like, you know, we're minimizing it or taking quality away or, you know, whatever, or being afraid of it. What I meant by compress was that you're going to have to kind of create a fluid sense of Mary's journey through that world. And especially when you're telling a story, which initially is about Mary not understanding anything and then slowly understanding things, that's very, very difficult to tell unless you either spend loads of time or a very fluidly told version of that time. And that did take quite a while. And then when we were shooting, so we went to Spain to shoot a lot of the exterior stuff. And when we were there, we had a lot of scripted stuff, but we also had a list of beats that myself and Russell, visual effects supervisor, who's directing a lot of that stuff, came up with, which were Mary does this, Mary does that, Metal leads her over here, there's a nice location, why don't we shoot Mary doing this or that? And we didn't really know how much of it was going to cut it, quite literally. And we didn't quite know how it was going to work, but it felt like beyond the central scenes that we knew we were going to need, it felt that this might be, a set of beats would be very helpful. So then we worked through that. And then when we got to editing, then it became a sense of, okay, how do you make this dynamic interesting, not dull? How do you do it without resorting to Mary doing a voiceover where Mary says, oh, Tuesday I met Atal, Wednesday, you know, she showed me a seed pod. Friday I thought, maybe this is dust. Is this dust? ? In the diary. You know, we just didn't want to, I just really, really didn't want to resort to that personally because I just felt it would be really cheap.
It's very Craig David as well.
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah, by the time I met Atal on a Monday, yeah, he'd taken me out and shoot me home by Sunday. Yeah, and then, you know, the editing experience of that was more of the same, just kind of how do you make it coherent? How do you keep it rolling? How do you get the right balance of information versus experience? How do you make it visual? How do you make it sumptuous? But how do you also hopefully get people to understand what it's all about? And, you know, it was difficult.
Well, look, I think you did a really good job as an audience member. You conveyed it really well that moment. But for me, one thing that really struck me in that was the use of subtitles to convey the slow understanding of a language. I don't think I'd seen that before. I thought that was quite a nice touch.
Yeah, that was something. So when we, I had been, I think I said it already, but I've been worrying about Malefa for a while, and I think I'd managed to, you know, I'd been a latecomer to the books, and I think I'd read the book, you know, while we were finishing season two. So we hadn't yet got into, you know, prep or anything for season three. So there were a couple of things that suddenly like bonked me in the head. And one of them was, oh boy, how on earth are you going to do this? And I had a few references, some of which are reasonably random. But one of them was initially, okay, actually animated subtitles There's a movie called Night Watch, a Russian vampire movie that
Oh
does
yeah.
some interesting subtitle
Yeah, it
stuff.
comes up with blood and stuff, doesn't it? Yeah.
That's what I thought of when she started talking.
For sure. And you know, that was some of those are percolating, but now that didn't go into the script. I think that was kind of, for me, that was part of a long process and talking with the execs about it. It was a long process of, for me, keeping stuff in the bank at the back of my head for like, okay, will this work? And I'm not quite sure. But initially, the first line of approach was to just play the scenes very naturalistically and not do anything too bonkers stylistically, which, you know, you could do. But we decided to play it quite, you know, real. And, you know, one of Russell's references, it was kind of Terrence Malick style almost, which I'm not quite sure that's, you know, where we ended up, but that was kind of an initial aspect of it. And then when we were editing, really, it was actually only at a point where myself and the editor were working on it kind of siloed off. I can't remember. I think we'd shown a few versions of it to people, but it started off, you know, very rough, you know, like very, very rough. And you've obviously got no animation, you've just got a random puppet head and all this kind of stuff, right? But by the time we maybe got into our second or third pass of it, I think then I dropped the subtitle idea and thought, okay, right, but how would you do it? And how would you make it so that it's not just trans. So I guess, okay, the interesting aspect about it, which is hopefully what you're responding to, is what the subtitles are doing or is trying to visually, even though text on screen is not, you know, traditionally very interesting to look at, they're visually trying to show you what the process of learning a language is. So certain words stick, they literally hang on the screen in the air, and then little by little, those building blocks build up into her understanding. And so we just had to, myself and the editor went through and tried to track through what Mary could take from each of those scenes. And it's probably not a spoiler to say that we, you know, kept on rewriting Atal's lines in order to kind of reach a point at which Atal's line could help us make sense of what the scene was, and ultimately just end up on what do these things mean to Mary.
I mean, it seems to me that in general you have a major storytelling challenge this season, and this even more than the last two, because everyone, especially at the beginning of the season, is utterly scattered across worlds, and you have to keep all those plates spinning and sort of reintroduce an audience after a gap of what, 2 years? You know, I feel like those first episodes must have been something of a headache as well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that there was a lot of stuff to get in there. And I think, you know, traditionally early episodes in a season of anything tend to be the most fruity in terms of how you can kind of compress them right down, but in terms of what you prioritize. I mean, what you've got, particularly in the first two eps, arguably, is you've kind of got, you know, the return of dynamic James McAvoy kind of powering you through. So what you had to do was just kind of hang on to him, because actually what the story's doing, which is, you know, a bit different, is that he's kind of charging through, but actually Lyra Daphne, who is your traditional lead, is, you know, largely comatose. So what you're doing is you're kind of what you're kind of doing is just trying to set up the stakes. And through James, what you're able to do is you're able to set up a knowledge and an understanding, and through a gunway, of what the greater stakes are. And so by focusing on that and by playing some of that out, you kind of get ahead before all the major characters start to meet properly, you know?
Starting with essentially Commando Azrael gives you a lot of. It gives you a quick pressy and a quick reminder, as well as, you know, a bit of, yeah, as you say, dynamism.
You're seeing some of it through a Gunway's eyes, and, you know, so a Gunway is your audience, and he's coming, you know, as written, he's coming from a world without all of these things. So, you know, with some similarities to the other world. So yeah, you're kind of hanging on to Gunway's point of view as well, as a kind of someone who's reasonably sane and grounded.
How about just breaking down the philosophy of this season? You know, because you are literally dealing with a war on heaven. You're dealing with the issues and ideas of religion that Philip Pullman, I think, wanted to explore in these books, really only come to a massive head in the third one, it feels like. And so what was it like trying to get a balance between that and the sort of the adventurer nature of the show, and, you know, the fact that you have these two kids on an adventure, even if it's one that's getting steadily and steadily sort of darker and higher stakes?
I mean, it's really tricky. I would say quite a lot of that type of story challenge was always there. It's usually kind of told through characters that's kind of arguably aside from Lyra and Will, if you know what I mean. So although Lyra encounters some of that early on, she's, you know, young and therefore doesn't have a complete understanding. So I think, yeah, the difficult thing is to try and translate for an audience, promise that something big is going to come, a little bit unclear what that is, and then try to work through some of the more abstract elements of it. Yeah, very tricky.
That's fair.
Can you tell us a bit, Stephen, about the land of the dead? We've seen, you know, the afterlife presented quite a lot through TV and films over many decades, but this one feels a little bit different, I guess. What when you went into that, were you really looking to sort of make a mark or stamp it out or make it look different to what we might have expected?
Well, I think, you know, the art department and Joel Collins, production designer, are kind of central to that. I think, you know, the idea that it's a place that's, the land of the dead is constructed from people's memories, and that this is kind of visualized by the idea that people's objects make up the walls of the area. And actually also, sorry, rewinding a wee bit, I kind of forget how this happens in the book or how it's told in the book, but we go through the suburbs of the dead first and land of the dead, and suburbs of the dead, which is your first stage, is slightly more of a kind of civil service experience. It's a bit, you know, closer to what I thought was a slightly more Brazil-like version of things. I mean, I think, you know, it was a great deal of it is down to art department and, you know, what they felt and what Joel felt could be done in that space. I mean, the biggest challenge really actually was the harpies and how much of the harpies we could show, because they're so catastrophically expensive, and how you could use them to drive it. Because arguably, I mean, you could say this about loads of different elements, and it's always a bit tricky, which is, on the one hand, you could say they're not the most important thing in the show for sure, but you do need them and they do serve a purpose, and, you know, they ultimately drive the story forward. So it was just a question of how you come back to that, like how do you use them to drive Lyra forward ultimately, you know, which is, I think, the question I was always asking myself throughout the seasons. Really, that's the thing you have to return to.
Spoken like a true producer, Stephen. The you know, mourning your budget as you go.
I did find that fascinating because Jane talked about this as well, the fact that, you know, this is a big budget show by, I don't know, Coronation Street standards, although I don't know what their wages bill is. Maybe it's very high. But, it, you know, by the standards of a sort of Lord of the Rings or a Game of Thrones, this is much, much smaller.
Oh, we're a fraction, yeah.
So it doesn't look it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that is because, so I think one of the reasons it doesn't look it, I hope, is because, you know, there's a sense of taste and a sense of excellence across the departments. And so, you know, and visual effects is a big part of that. So I think, you know, I guess the feeling was, you know, you never let something visually creep in that lets you down. And so if you're operating at that level, which is absolutely what everyone's intent was across the board, then that means that you're probably quite realistic about how much it's going to cost to do that thing right. And therefore, pretty quickly, you start having to let go of things. I mean, obviously, yeah, you would, you know, in an ideal world, you would populate scenes with even more, but it does force us to be far more choice in what we deploy when, and more kind of story specific, I hope. So I don't think there's too many examples of times where we've kind of used very expensive ways of just doing kind of shoe leather, you know, that we tend to kind of make it pretty, we try to use the stuff pretty boldly and kind of as a way to drive the story forward. You know, that's the ultimately all it's about.
I have to say, the shot of Pan on the quayside as Lyra's leaving, and it's a much sort of closer in shot than we often get of him, and it felt like that was a moment that was kind of a hero moment for him.
Oh, I think that scene is, I think, might be our best scene. I mean, it, you know, it has reduced me to tears more than once. You know, and you kind of, one of the funny things about going through a process of filmmaking is that you, especially the way that, you know, how long things take to do, and you have to kind of largely do things in a certain kind of order in order to help everyone work and help everyone finish and, you know, do their piece. But what it means is that, you know, so you have it at script stage is very strong, The shoot was really strong when it's just Daphne against a puppet or against an empty space. And then you get into the edit, and when what we were doing was we reached a very strong version of that quite quickly, but then we started to embellish it. It's one of the real pleasures of some of that material was that it was already very strong. So in the end, what you're doing is you're not kind of doing damage limitation. What you're doing is you're finessing and fine tuning very, very quickly. So it actually, a lot of that stuff got expanded further. So the scene got kind of stronger and stronger, and then it gets handed over to visual effects. And we have a kind of collaboration over a number of months, let's say, on everything, but on that specific scene. And little by little, you know, Russell's pushing animation further and further and further. You know, we had lots of conversations, Russell and I, about, you know, at what point does Pan turn away in conversation? You know, we were kind of, you're largely locked into what you shot, but, you know, you try to think of creative ways to do that. And then, you know, within that, you've also got the day on which you record Pan's voice, which I think from memory, we did two sessions of, some of which was pretty kind of heartbreaking to record. It was kind of extraordinary. And then, you know, you get to music and you hope that the music will push it further. And then in the end, you got sound mix and the grade and all these kinds of things. And each of these stages, from my point of view, is one where you reintroduce yourself to what the scene is, and I try to refresh myself of what has come before, so that I can try and encounter each stage anew, so that we can make the, from my point of view anyway, from my role in it, make the strongest choices, so that we can end up at the absolute ultimate version of it, which I do think that's an example, I think, of if anything in the show that we've achieved, I'm pretty sure that must be our strongest moment, I think.
I agree. I think that's quite, it is quite an accomplishment that you guys managed to deliver, I agree, one of the most heartbreaking moments of this series and show. And it's between, you know, a digital character and a human character. And that is no small achievement. So I guess well done on that. And you guys do manage to create a sense of scale when you have to, when it's, you know, both literally scale or just emotional scale with the tools you have. But I'm hung up now on the cost of a harpy and how many demons I could get for a harpy. How, like, what's the demon to harpy ratio?
Well, I can't, off the top of my head, I think a harpy costs you somewhere between 10,000 and 15,000 pounds a shot.
Oh my God. Whoa. We could have a whip around, Helen. We could get a harpy for the show. Get a mascot.
Yeah. I mean, the old leathery puppet head looked quite good, but it didn't really quite live up to, you know, what the digital version was.
Fair enough.
I can imagine, yeah.
Was it a bit Muppet's Christmas Carol?
Yes, yeah, a wee bit.
Yeah, look, they're well employed anyway. They are freaking terrifying looking, so.
Very good.
Yeah. It works out in the end. Well, listen, I think that's it. But thank you so much for joining us. And I would say looking forward to next season, but there's something we can't with this one now. So looking forward to whatever's next.
Yeah, me too. No, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks very much. Right, let's talk about the Magisterium and Mrs. Coulter. So she's in a bit of a pickle. They, you know, they're going to sever her demon to murder her daughter. I thought it was interesting that she says good when they say you're going to sever your demon. Part of me is like, is she just, you know, she just, is that sarcastic? Is she just like, yeah, oh, you know, is she being trying to just get one up on them and be powerful? Oh, good. Yeah, you do that. That sounds great. Or is part of her like, I think because of the, you know, I think part of her would almost like to be separated from her demon, right? Or am I reading into that too much?
Yeah, no, I think there's always been that conflict, isn't there? And I think it's been better, but I think it's mostly bravado. I think that is mostly bravado of the sense of, oh, what does she know that we don't? You know, maybe this won't work after all, kind of a play. But also I think that she genuinely does have things in her life that she would give a lot to not have haunting her anymore. And I think that, you know, like I said before, I think there's a huge amount of trauma there, and I think that her demon carries a lot of it,
and that's why she pushes it away.
Yeah. I think so I think there's still that little bit of conflict there, even though they're a bit more on the same page than they ever were at the beginning of season one.
So we see Father Gomez, he gets a bit of a setup plot here where he basically says, there's a bit of an odd moment here where he's like, he stands up to MacPhail, and you think, right, okay, he's maybe making a power play here, or he's seeing maybe Coulter has shown him what a kind of a fraud MacPhail is. So excuse me, Father President MacPhail. And you think, oh, this is his big moment. But then he kind of comes back kind of conciliatory and says, I'm so sorry, my father president, I gotta, but I have an idea, let's go hunt this serpent. So I was a bit confused as to his motivations here. I think maybe what I suspect is he's playing MacPhail in the second instance in order to get off to find this so-called serpent, right?
Yeah, I think what we have here are slightly different kinds of fanaticism, I think. I think like Father Gomez is a full-on fanatic. He genuinely is horrified at the idea of MacPhail touching someone else's demon, which MacPhail is, I think, also a religious fanatic in this episode, and that really comes across in a way that it hasn't always before. You know, sometimes he seemed purely like a career priest, if you know what I mean. But now he's very much, there is real fanaticism there as well, as we see as the episode goes on. There's almost religious ecstasy when he's planning this big move. He's going to save the world. He's going to be the authority's new favorite, you know, and there is that yeah. kind of genuine, like look he looks me. Like transported, right? In those later scenes. But there's also his little, the chink in his armor. There is the obsession with Mrs. Coulter and that very unhealthy draw that he feels towards her. And that's what you see in that moment with the demon. So yeah, I think Father Gomez knows, like, you know, if he were a cardinal, I think it would have been a very different outcome. But as a lowly, very young priest, I think he knows his time has not yet come and he is not in no position yet challenge. To challenge MacPhail. Yeah, yeah, that's what I think.
No, I think you're right. And looking forward to Gomez on the hunt for the serpent, because he's a good villain to have in the wild.
He's so hissable. I hate him so much. Yeah, he has no kindness, no mercy, no empathy in him. Like, if his idea of mercy is a kid dying in the mother's arms, that's no kind of mercy at all, you know?
It's awful, isn't it? But like you said, he's like, the power of a fanatic is quite terrifying when they are completely resolute, because MacPhail has enough weakness that he can be overcome or manipulated, but Gomez, the only thing that will work is a rock to the skull, as Mr. Coulter learned. I thought the show was so good when in that build up to Mrs. Coulter's execution, that whatever the Lorne Balfe score was, just like boom boom, it was like I was like, oh wow, I felt the power of that march towards that severing, and then it was like, just the whole thing was just super literally explosive, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really yeah. was. It was hard at times to kind of definitely track what was going on at first. Like, I wasn't really super clear on what happened in those final moments. So, you know, so obviously, like, I'm clear in the first part. So they've got her in her prison dubs. If we're talking about the power of clothing again, they've tried to strip that from her. She still looks great, obviously. She's kind of on hunger strike because that's the power she can take from them. She won't eat when she's told. She's kind of conspiring with Roke. She is trying to manipulate Dr. Cooper, as we learn eventually successfully. She does talk her around. You know, if he's prepared to kill me, then what the hell do you think he'll do to you? And MacPhail, when he arrives for that execution or that severing, all doled up in his formal robes, you know, he's almost like, hey, this is yeah. it. It's all happening now, you know. It's really kind of all building and building and building. And then she does manage to escape. She does manage to get out thanks to Dr. Cooper. Roke kills some of the guards. Dr. Cooper stops the blade from falling. MacPhail is forced to deal with her. The monkey is freed by Roke, ends up trying to free Mrs. Coulter. Okay, like, I'm with it all through this. MacPhail starts trying to reset the machine, rushes in. He crushes Roke. Mrs. Coulter's basically beating him up, but she can't. She and the monkey worry about Lyra, and they go and see. They're distracted by that thing, by that targeting system, and they go looking basically for Lyra.
Great Death Star, that targeting.
Very Death Star. First yeah. Death Star, 100%. And then MacPhail straps himself in, puts his lizard seems to get into the cage of its own device.
Yes.
Right?
Or I guess they must. Yeah. Yeah. It felt like they both knew what they needed to do, right?
In this moment, this sacrificial. So again, that kind of religious ecstasy, like he's looking up in glory, but Mrs. Coulter pulls out the bomb guidancey thing that had the hair in it before. So we're like, phew, all is well. And then the hammer falls.
Yes. So yeah, I'll agree with you. It does feel a little bit unclear as to how that has happened, but we do know that he has been severed.
We know he has been severed. We know he's gone. He is off the table. That's a series wrap on Father President MacPhail.
Yeah.
But what comes basically is like a tiny moment earlier in the episode comes back to bite them. So, you know, Azrael's prisoner has been freed, goes home to Metatron, reports in. Metatron's basically like, we'll see about that. Fuck that guy. And his response is, you think dust can make you gods? Let's see how you fare without it. So it's almost like a lightning bolt hitting the chamber that kills Father MacPhail rather than a button
the machine
being
itself.
Pressed.
Yeah, because the machine has been dismantled, right? So I think it's something, a higher power has intervened here when science was left out, right? So that's Metatron is delivering he's responding to Azrael's message, right? Essentially, yeah.
Yes, emphatically so. And Mrs. Coulter is basically left there to scream and cover her ears. That is not what, you know, we were led to believe was going to happen at the end of this episode. So I guess a literal act of God. What are you going to do?
Yes, yeah, literally. And I like the way you described that look on MacPhail's face, because and that's what's kind of frustrating about it as an audience, because I think he feels vindicated, right, at the end of this, because he is getting direct communication from God, like that, and that's like, it's making him feel even more like what he's doing is the right thing, and I hate that he got to go out on that note.
Oh, that's true. I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah.
Oh, how annoying. You wanted all his hopes and dreams to be crushed.
Exactly. That's all I'm asking for.
Oh, we're nice people, really. I promise. Mostly.
Right. Well, I think that wraps it up. That takes us to the end of episode 5. See you guys for next week, episode 6.
It's going to be another big one, I suspect. See you then. Bye-bye.
His Darker Materials is a Stripped Media production. Our producer and editor is Maddie Searle. All our music was composed by John Dix. Our artwork was created by Sam Gilby. Our executive producers are Kobe Amanaka and Tom Wally. Our hosts are Helen O'Hara and myself, Dave Corkery. A big thank you to Ian Johnson at IJPR, to Bad Wolf at the BBC, and to all our guests for taking the time to chat to us. If you want to chat to us, you can do it at producers@stripped.media.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.